listening? It is I, Numator479. According to our studies of your puny mammalian race, we discovered you like very good coffee. And while it is our evolutionary purpose to cause you psychic torment, we want you awake and vivacious to give it. So try our new blend from Spring Hill Jack Coffee, Reptilian in the Morning. Our proprietary blend of lightly roasted cacao husks will have you immediately energized upon emerging from the pain cloaca with all your slippery new eggs. Thanks, honey. Hot, I'm cold-blooded. Thanks to Spring Hill Jack and Last Podcast on the Left, I'm ready to get out there and eat some babies. Get out of the way, Hillary Clinton!
There's no place to escape to.
This is the Last Podcast
on the Left.
Right from your glade.
That's when the cannibalism started.
No playback stuff in this one?
Nope.
Not unless we want to go through throwing copper.
Not track by track.
You don't want to listen to all of live?
Like Val, listen to throwing copper. I'll listen to Secret Samadhi.
You are talking mess on Secret Samadhi. But I do, unfortunately, what you talked about how it's unfortunate, Eddie,
yeah.
About how sometimes you recognize qualities in yourself in some of these stories.
Yeah.
And I love live. I love live, and I've always said it is school shooter music. It is for school shooters. It is for rage-filled men that hair can only grow in a 3-inch circle on the top of their head, and they all kind of look like a party favor.
And we're going to get into why the fuck we're talking about live here on today's episode of Last Podcast on the Left.
Are we finally going to find out where dolphins go to die?
My name's Marcus Parks. I'm here with Henry Zabrowski, live super fan Henry Zabrowski.
Yeah! He's poor man's Maynard. You don't think so?
We're going to get a lot of angry emails from Tool fans on that one.
But poor man's Maynard.
Even
the
so.
The guy from live.
Yeah, I know. Ed?
Am I not wrong?
Yeah, you're wrong.
You think that you don't think. You doesn't remind you Maynard?
No, not at all.
Nah.
But being like a music that you could do you could do figure eights in your pickup true in the
donuts.
Parking lot.
It's called donuts.
Yeah, but you could do it in a 7-Eleven or something, and you're just going around and around and around going, man, like, I don't love you. I don't. I'm coming back, Teresa.
And, of course, Ed Larson.
How you doing? I don't like either of those bands.
Both Live and Tool are featured on the soundtrack to somebody who's showing up in front of an ex's home demanding to be heard out.
Well, Live is on the girlfriend soundtrack. Tool's on the boyfriend soundtrack.
So when we last left John Bunting and the rest of the morons involved in the Snowtown murders, they just killed Robert Wagner's former girlfriend, Vanessa Lane, one of the gang's two trans victims. In Vanessa's murder, they had been assisted by Lane's latest young boyfriend, a paranoid schizophrenic named Thomas Trevelyan. Trevelyan had been convinced by Bunting and Wagner, the two main villains in this story, that killing Vanessa Lane was the right thing to do because Vanessa was, admittedly, a predator.
So up to this point, to catch you guys up and to remind you, Bunting and Wagner are two pieces of shit morons that have, like, they have mobilized a group of other fellow morons to help them and their two-man vendetta against people they don't like,
yeah,
inside of their small town. And at first it sounded like, oh, he's got these kind of he has a messiah-like complex.
Savior complex, I'd say, is more like.
The missionary killer. The whole point is that he's doing this for a purpose.
And also, Adelaide has over 1 million people in it.
It does, yes. I know now, but now I understand. Adelaide's a big city. I understand Snowtown, too, is just a suburb.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's technically kind of cute, and most of the stuff didn't happen there. But that, you know, but branding's not happening, guys. The rebranding is not happening.
Yeah,
Snowtown,
it's done. It's over.
But he's immediately going to jump off his MO.
Yeah, he is. Now, Thomas Trevelyan was 18 by the time the 42-year-old Vanessa had got a hold of him, but he'd been diagnosed as schizophrenic at the age of 14, so he was, in all respects, a vulnerable member of society.
He was extremely vulnerable.
For whatever reason, the delusion that Thomas had latched onto was that he was in the army, and he would stalk the streets like a soldier on a spy mission, dressed in clothes bought from the army surplus.
Oh, you call that a knife? That's a knife.
Spoon.
Oh, knife! Oh, knife!
I see you've played Knifey Spoony before. But while that may sound harmless, Trevelyan was usually armed with a carving knife. And while he was playing army, he'd often hide in bushes and jump out with his knife at the ready when he heard a noise.
Ah, I got you there. Sorry. Let me scare you. Also, he's just having fun. It's a bit of a life.
Someone needs to clean up this bush as well.
It's bush up for a day.
Now, Thomas was all right if he was on his medication.
Yeah.
But by the time he met Vanessa Lane, he was wearing a literal aluminum foil hat to protect his brain from satellites. So suffice to say, he wasn't taking care of himself.
It's called baked potato couture. It's cute. It's fun.
Now, after the murder of Vanessa Lane, Thomas moved in with Robert Wagner, who by this point was shacking up with a woman named Maxine. Now, things went all right for a bit, but in November of 1997, Trevelyan threatened to kill a puppy with his carving knife in front of Maxine's daughter.
Now, Trevelyan did have schizophrenia,
yeah.
So he very could have thought of the puppy as some sort of, like, creature, right, that was coming at him all the time going, ow, ow, ow. Imagine if you looked at a little puppy, but you thought it was a little man, mm-hmm. and he was making a lot of weird noises and shit, and fucking like burrowing your other dog's belly, like looking for milk.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd be mad at that little man, right? And then you'd be like, I'm gonna kill this little man if he tries to do something to my other dog, then. And then it turns out, but then you're not an army.
I mean, one of the things that I'm kind of getting the sense of here is that the vast majority in these of the people in this story are very aggressive.
Like it's Australia.
Yeah. But what's funny about that, though, is that this is Adelaide, and Adelaide prides themselves on being the only city in Australia that wasn't settled by convicts. They call themselves the free city, the city of churches, because they were settled by Christians and such.
Oh, so they grow their convicts there.
Yes.
Yeah, homegrown. That's what you get when you grow a convict in Australia.
Yeah. Well, thanks to Trevelyan for that.
Well, after the puppy incident, Bunting and Wagner offered to take Trevelyan on, quote, a nice drive in the country, and he was never seen alive again. Now, in this murder, Bunting didn't kill in service of his mission to rid Adelaide of its pedophiles, nor was the murder a matter of principle. Like with Suzanne Allen, Trevelyan was an inconvenience, and Bunting and Wagner had come to rely on murder as their first choice for solving any problem. And so, on November 5th, Bunting and Wagner drove Trevelyan out to a rural area and convinced him to slip a rope around his neck, stand on a crate, and jump off, hanging himself.
And you think that was all done with words?
I think it might have been.
I think, because
that's the thing, is that how do you get some, I guess you threaten somebody.
To kill them.
Either you do it or we do it. Either you do it or we do it, yeah. I suppose so.
Waved a beef patty in front of them, you know?
Yeah.
Okay.
I imagine they physically forced him to do it.
Yeah.
They probably put it around his neck and said, you could do it or we could do it. Or they just did it.
Yeah.
And it made it look like a suicide.
Yeah.
Or the dog ordered the hit.
Never allow a dog to understand the hierarchy of the home. Because as soon as they know, because the laws of power.
Yeah.
You got to attack the shepherd, scatter the sheep.
Well, the body was then left there to be discovered. But since Trevelyan had made a few suicide attempts already, his death wasn't investigated at all. Authorities also deduced that since Trevelyan had almost $7 in his pockets, this was not a robbery.
Nah. Yeah. It's not coming.
Is that a robbery? Yeah. Nah, he's got $7 in there.
Yeah. Oh, would have taken that.
Yeah, that's Salisbury Rich right there.
Yeah, right there. That's like 9 speeding tickets to Salisbury.
But we do know that Bunting and Wagner orchestrated Trevelyan's death, because every time they drove past the spot where Trevelyan was hanged, they made sure to point out to fellow accomplice Jamie Vlasakis that this was the spot where they hanged Trevelyan.
I wonder if that has the same lasting power as there's construction being done around where my house is, and there's a sign that says loose gravel, and every single time I walk past with Natalie when we walk the dogs, I go, oh, loose gravel, that's my burlesque name. And she stopped laughing.
She stopped laughing.
She just doesn't seem to understand that that's a funny bit.
But the more you say it, the funnier it gets.
The sign has to go.
Yeah.
It's not me. Yeah. It's the sign.
You can't also just say gravel. Yeah. You know, all gravel's loose.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, unloose gravel is rocks.
Tight gravel actually is a better burlesque name.
Now, prior to his death, and unbeknownst to Wagner and Bunting, Trevelyan had confessed to the murder of Vanessa Lane to his cousin Lenore, detailing every step of the murder from the killing itself to the disposal of the body, as well as how they were all using Vanessa's social security pin to cash her welfare checks.
I think that had a lot to do with it. I think that he was a weirdo. And he was an inconvenience to he was a weirdo to them, and he was an inconvenience. And now, like, the main it's the vibe has changed.
Yeah,
is that we are now seeing them transition. We were talking in last episode about how John Bunting and Robert Wagner were eventually kind of like they were gaining the trust of all of these people. Like, people were starting to kind of like come to them with issues, quote unquote.
Yeah,
but that's kind of like they gave them the first taste of power, and then it became I gotta go kill.
Yeah.
Like, immediately they were like, oh, they kind of jump past the sheriff part. A lot of times when you're a sheriff, before you misuse that power, like, you got, like, I would say maybe a 6 weeks of, like, opening up a Walgreens or, like, you know, being at a highway with the shovel, being like, look what we're doing. You know, have a fun thing. And it's not till 6 months later that you, like, kill a little boy in a chokehold.
Now, Trevelyan's cousin didn't believe him at the time, but after he showed up dead, she went to the police and told them what Trevelyan told her, but she was dismissed and told that Vanessa Lane had moved to Queensland, because that's what she had said. The police were operating off this premise because while Bunting and Wagner were torturing Vanessa under Trevelyan's supervision, they had forced Vanessa to call her mother and tell her that she was moving to Queensland with a new boyfriend and wouldn't ever be coming back. That was good enough for the cops.
And the process by
which... At least at that time.
Yes. Yeah. And it was a... It's not a fun process by which they were coached. So basically they were all... murdered in the BTK fashion for the most part.
And we'll get a lot more into the actual, you know, nuts and bolts of it here.
Yeah, but it was like a slow choke and then a release, choke and release. And so what they would do is they would choke them, sadly, and then unrelease, have them say a line into a voice recorder, choke them again, unrelease, have them say a line into a voice recorder, then they would take that and they would edit it together. Mm. And they didn't realize that until way after all the crimes, until way into the middle of the investigation.
Yeah. Well, this seemingly idiotic ruse worked. And I don't know if this speaks to the intelligence of the people of Salisbury North or to their transient and mercurial nature, but family members and friends of victims would accept these pre-recorded messages as real communications again and again.
I think it's because the people they choose were already of a transient nature, and they, in the very beginning, they were people that, quote-unquote, people wouldn't miss.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also a lot of these people, like you were saying, they won't miss them. They're kind of maybe... happy that they moved.
God, yeah. That's what everybody's kind of saying. Like, right now, that's also probably why the cops aren't digging in too hard.
Yeah, because they're looking around the neighborhood and they're like, hey, this looks wrapped up. Let's go back home.
You remember that super aggressive pervert? He's not here anymore. Oh, shit. That was the entire thing. That was the entire thing.
Now, concerning people talking about the murders, Bunting wasn't being especially discreet himself. As I mentioned last episode, Bunting was talkative to the point where everyone knew his opinions about everything. He hated soccer. He hated TV, especially soap operas and dramas. Hated all of it. Hated almost everything.
I don't like it. I hate it. Oh, the television lies. He never listens when I talk.
But one show he did enjoy was Australia's Most Wanted. One night in July of 1998, Bunting and his girlfriend Elizabeth, who was, if you'll remember, Jamie Vlasakis' mother, they were watching an episode when a segment aired about an unidentified skeleton that was found in the Adelaide area. Unbeknownst to the authorities, this was the skeleton of Clinton Trezise, Bunting's first victim. And since Bunting had already told Elizabeth Harvey about other murders, he added this one to the pile, turning to her and saying, quote,
"That's my handiwork."
Which is terrible. It's terrifying.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's not... It's the equivalent when I see, like, one of my friends in a commercial. I'm going, it's my buddy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the level of gravity at me. I'm like, yeah, 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 I know the guy.
Oh, yeah, Jason's doing real well for himself these days.
Yeah, that's literally, like, oh, I say, like, oh, yeah, look at that. It's literally, it's like,
Hey, look at it. Made the news.
And like, she was not, she would end up being an accessory.
Yeah. Now, aside from crime shows, Bunting was also a big Stephen King fan, choosing the 1998 book Bag of Bones, which thankfully has nothing to do with pedophilia, as his favorite.
This is one of those where
it's a weird choice.
You're such a fucking contrarian that you must choose one of his middling modern books.
I'd never even fucking heard of it.
I dislike Bag of Bones. It's a good summer read. It's Stephen King, but it's nowhere near his best.
No.
His best is The Shining.
The Shining. Yeah. The Shining. Even
the Carrie. I love Carrie. I love
Christine.
Hearts of Atlantis is better.
Is that true? Have you read Hearts of Atlantis?
I don't read.
Yeah, I know you don't.
The Stand. The Stand is incredible.
I feel like it's him being like, I like the new dumb one. It's because nobody else likes it. Nobody else likes me.
Bunting also obsessively watched The Silence of the Lambs to quote-unquote study Hannibal Lecter's mannerisms.
I always like to smell perfumes or meet a woman first thing I ask her. I say, hey, what's that you're wearing? Is it Motorola? You what's that you're wearing? Some kind of gunk? What kind of shit gunk you got on your breasts? Yeah, old bitch, I'm not as suave. I need to work on it.
And he read Colin Wilson's true crime books to study the habits and methods of various serial killers, seemingly focusing in on John Wayne Gacy. And this was, of course, highly ironic, because John Wayne Gacy is probably at the top of the list of serial killers who molested the most boys. Although Dean Corll could probably make a run for that spot as well. But besides pedophiles, John Bunting also hated women and was said to have preferred the, quote, cold, impersonal companionship of his blow-up doll.
Do you think the chances are that he also molested children?
You know what? I struggled with that question.
Yeah.
Actually, at the very least, you know, I think that he had urges.
Yeah.
I think that he definitely had, he wanted to.
Anyone who flips out this much, like, there's something else going on.
Yeah.
We've talked about this.
Projection is the word. Yeah.
Projection.
For, yeah.
And I get some. It's hard because I got a little bit of criticism when we were doing the Anders Breivik series talking about how does his massive homophobic streak, does that belie it's like a classic trope now.
Yeah.
That if you hate gay people, you obviously, there's something in there.
Yeah.
Like if you're violently against one specific thing, a lot of times it looks like, oh, I'm very much so into this thing.
Yeah.
But it's hard because it makes, you know, people that are gay mad. Because you're like, don't put him on our team just because he's fucking a shithead. You know what I mean? Like, well, why are you doing this? And so this guy, I don't know. Again, I'm not trying to rile up our pedophile listeners by applying John Bunting to the pedophile community.
Mm-hmm.
Got a lot of messages about that, about the idea of non-practicing pedophiles.
Yeah, I read some.
And it seems to be the jury's out on non-practicing pedophiles.
Yes. And I will also say, I am also well aware that a straight man can date a trans woman. Yes, I'm well aware of that.
That's a straight relationship because it's a woman.
Because it's a woman, yes.
Yes.
But seemingly...
It's very complicated.
It's all very complicated.
You know how you get to prison for pedophilia? Practice.
Yeah. I'm an expert, they say.
Well, seemingly, the only people John Bunting cared about and was laser-focused upon was young boys.
He's like the Jordan Peterson of serial killers.
Because he's focused on...
The boys
are doing.
Well, the idea of, like, he's the savior of boys.
Yes.
Live from your grave.
Now, by 1998, Bunting and Wagner had tasted enough blood where they were using almost anything as an excuse to murder someone. Plus, they had the added bonus of being able to use the bank cards of their victims. See, all of the people Bunting and Wagner killed were on government welfare, and those payments were automatically deposited into the victims' bank accounts.
Coincidence?
I mean, it's just the way it worked.
But part of me wonders whether or not that was a feature into why we're also killing.
It eventually became a feature.
Yeah.
Because as long as a body was never found, Bunting could forge documents, alter bank details, and pose as victims if need be to make sure those payments kept coming. In all, it's estimated that Bunting and Wagner scammed the Australian government out of tens of thousands of dollars.
And man, you could really tell by their lifestyle. Yeah. it's interesting. They did make a bunch of money, but then they didn't buy anything with it. They just kind of put it away.
Shovels and barrels.
Yes. and a bank.
But when it comes to killing for their own reasons outside of their mission, their next victim was neither a pedophile nor was he gay. His name was Gavin Porter, and he was killed simply because Bunting didn't like having him around.
I view him as the reason why he was murdered was because he was gaining undue influence over Jamie Vaslakis.
That's also a big possibility. See, Gavin was a heroin addict, but so was Bunting's accomplice, Jamie Vaslakis. Gavin and Jamie had met in a methadone program, but after they left, they moved in together and fell deep into the drug world. They dealt, delivered, and even transported sex workers, all so they could feed a $300 a day habit. But while Bunting was fine with Jamie doing heroin, or he at least accepted it, he said that he didn't like Gavin specifically because he was a user. Most likely, I'd imagine that it was because Vlasakis kowtowed to Bunting, where Gavin didn't.
And he viewed Jamie Vaslakis as his little protege.
Oh, very much so.
It's his sub-son. He was like, this guy, he's going to be just like me. I can't wait for him to grow up by shrinking down to 5'6", gaining some nearsightedness and losing some hair. And he's going to be just like me. But then when he got in with Gavin, I think it was the heroin for a while was like, John Bunting is one of these guys.
Yeah.
Why do we maybe dislike Henry Rawlings sometimes? It's because he is a pain in the butt, straight edge man, right? In his way, where mm-hmm. he is very demanding. His views of
Henry life. Rollins?
Henry Rollins is a man that views life like a 13-year-old boy. All he likes to do is impress his friends by doing pull-ups, and he listens to records for fun once a week.
I believe that is a very unkind he's fucking... Like, that is not how... That is
hardcore dude that just believes in pull-ups and his bros hanging out where they just hang out, and they like... I want to say he like eats like a piece of candy, and he listens to one fun record that's not for work a week.
Yeah, the opinions of Henry Zebrowski about Henry Rollins do not reflect the opinions of Last Podcast Network.
Yeah, I for one think Henry is a liar!
A liar! But John Bunting was one of those truly miserable fuckface straight edge people.
Yeah.
That viewed his actions overall as the like the arbiter of morality, everything that's cool, and what he's doing, people should look up to him for what he's doing. And he did have a hang up about drugs, mm-hmm. much like he had a hang up about everything else. Obviously, he was an alcoholic and a murderer.
Yeah.
Which I would say is his worst quality.
Yeah.
I don't want to like seem like I'm on his team, but $300 a day in heroin, you know, someone's got to have a conversation with us.
this is the first time I've seen systematic murder and then body dismemberment as an intervention.
It's like, hey, we're doing this because we care about you. Everybody loves you. Yeah. All right, now help me burn his testicles.
If he was doing like $50 a day in heroin, you know, let it slide.
Honestly, yeah. I even think that that's a lot. A cool $5 a day. All I need is a little. That's all. Ooh, can I have a little sliver of heroin? I just smaller than that. Smaller than that.
Well, Jamie's mother, Elizabeth, liked Gavin. So he moved into the house that all of them were sharing at Murray Bridge, which I think had, if I've got this right, somewhere between 5 and 7 people living there now. There's a lot of fucking people shoved into this house.
And who says white people don't have culture?
There could be a couple in the tunnels.
But by April of 1998, there was one less person, because that was the month that John Bunting accidentally stabbed himself with a used syringe that Gavin had left lying around the house. Now, Bunting's anger was admittedly justified.
Yeah.
But Bunting took it to the level you'd expect from a man who'd already killed 6 people.
Yeah, I think he'd stub his toe and kill the bed.
You know, when he grabbed the needle and stabbed himself, the other guy was like, oh, no. Maybe I should leave.
All you have to hear is an ow. in the other room and you know you're fucked. Yeah.
Ganging up on Gavin, Bunting and Wagner tried an ambush in Gavin's car by attempting to slip a rope around his neck. But for the first time, a victim fought back, and Gavin managed to stab Bunting's hand with a screwdriver. But in the end, Gavin was dragged to the torture shed where he was strangled to death, much to Bunting's great joy and amusement. See, Bunting loved putting his face close to his victims because he liked feeling their last breaths. Ugh. And the moment in which that breath stopped was by far his favorite.
This is my favorite part! No, no, watch! Watch is my favorite part!
Turn the music down!
In other words, Bunting was through and through a killer and nothing more. There's nothing more to this guy.
I think he got hard from it.
Yeah. Now, a few hours after Gavin's murder, Jamie Vlasakis showed up to the house at Murray Bridge to find Bunting and Wagner casually eating Chinese food. Jamie was then taken to the shed and shown the corpse of his friend of 4 years.
And it was like that. It was literally,
hey, you want to see something?
Mm-hmm.
I got something. I think you're going to like it.
Yeah. And then it's just his buddy.
It's your buddy!
2 days later, Bunting ordered Jamie to put his friend's corpse in a barrel and store it in a shed at Robert Wagner's house. Perhaps because Gavin was Jamie's friend, he was the one who got Jamie's bank card, and Jamie immediately accessed Gavin's welfare money to buy heroin. Now, if you'll notice, the whole mission of killing pedophiles, it's sort of gone off track for Bunting and Wagner.
Yeah, I think we're like missing the reason for the season.
But in August of 1998, the mission found its way again when Jamie Vlasakis told Bunting that his older half-brother, Troy Ude, had molested him when he was a young boy.
Yeah, and when I was watching the movie, I was laughing a lot until that scene. And then I was like, what kind of wrestling is this?
Yeah, you know, what are you going to do? I don't know how to respond.
Did you like it?
It was, you know, when I watched the movie, you'd prep me on how horrible it was going to be. And then I saw that scene and I was just like, oh, yeah, it's bad. It's bad. But the movie's still good somehow.
I tell you what, that must have been a long day on set.
Oh, yeah. Or a very short one.
Yeah. Can we wrap this up? Actually, I was thinking if we could. I think we got it.
I want another angle.
I think we got it again and again. I can see it as an actor. What if we do it one shot, right? One and done, right? We just get it wrapped up, huh?
And so Bunting and Wagner decided that Ude needed to die. And this time, they'd make sure that Jamie Vlasakis was an active participant. Late one night, Jamie was woken up by Bunting and Wagner. They handed Jamie some handcuffs and a table leg that could be used as a club.
You're gonna lock this. It's gonna be fun.
And they told him to follow. Now, at this time, Troy Ude was actually living in the same house as Jamie Vlasakis, which might be why the whole molestation conversation came up in the first place.
Yeah, one fight over the PlayStation.
Yeah. Troy, and this is to keep things straight, he was Elizabeth's son by another man and was therefore Jamie's half-brother. Because I think Elizabeth had, what was it, 7 kids from 5 fathers?
Something fun like that.
She's a popular woman.
Yeah. I think it was Elizabeth that had that count.
She got that fertile. She got them fertile thick ass eyes. Ready to catch some sights, catch some worms.
And so Bunting went.
You know how it is. You see that big guy banana.
Catch them worms.
I had that egg. It waiting for the worm. Wait for the worm to give its kiss. Might get a son.
And so Bunting, Wagner, and Jamie went into Troy Ude's bedroom in the middle of the night, and at Bunting's go-ahead, they started beating him. And after he was suitably tenderized, Bunting ordered Jamie to handcuff his half-brother. But Jamie got overwhelmed and left the room. So it was Bunting and Wagner who forced Troy Ude into the bathroom and into the bathtub, which had become the de facto torture session location for, I'm sure, easy cleanup afterwards. Once Ude was subdued and cuffed, Bunting and Wagner told him to refer to them as Lord, Sir, and God, respectively. But they wanted Ude to choose his own alias for Jamie, something that would denote superiority. For some reason, Jude chose Moses. But because this was too Jewish for Wagner and Bunting,
Wrong answer.
That, remember, they were neo-Nazis.
Yes, the wrong
they
answer.
Still believe in Moses. He's in the Bible. This drives me crazy. It's like, Jesus was Jewish.
Well, they told him to choose again.
You know that's not fair. You choose it again.
Can you imagine that? And they say Bowser?
Noah, shit.
Oh, shit.
So they settled on Master for Jamie, and the torture began. First, Bunting and Wagner punched Jude in the genitals over and over again, screaming at him to shut up when he made a sound. They said the same when they crushed Jude's toes with pliers. Now, since tape recording a goodbye message who works so well with Vanessa Lane, Bunting and Wagner did it again with Jude. Bunting brought out a tape recorder and made Jude say over 20 sentences, like, I can't handle it at home no more, leave me the fuck alone, stay the fuck out of my life, and such and such. Now, at that point, Jamie got overwhelmed again and left the room. But this time, Bunting brought him back and told him to stay. And after stuffing a sock in Troy's mouth and wrapping his face in duct tape, Bunting worked himself into a violent frenzy, all while his favorite album played in the background. Now, the incredible synchronicity that we experienced with this series is that on the very day that we recorded the first episode, John Bunting's favorite band played a concert in Adelaide. That band was the 90s alt-rock group Live, and Bunting would often play their debut album, Throwing Copper, while torturing his victims.
It's so hard because all I can imagine is I just see every guy that looks like John Bunting is either, and I'm sorry, Eddie, and I'm not coming for you.
What are you talking?
You guys do look slightly similar, but I'm not coming for
you. Me and Bunting?
A little bit.
I thought he was a little guy.
He is, but you guys got the same structure.
He's wide?
Yes. And I
don't know. He looks more like the guy in the last season of 90 Day Fiancé who had the guinea pigs.
He does. He does.
Sorry, man. I like you.
Yes. Yeah. Like, because at first you look at him and you're like, oh, he likes Wilco.
Yeah.
And then you realize, like, no. He's not a draft beer. He's not an IPA sort of white. Right? He's the Live white. And
yeah.
I think
yeah.
Live white is just a step above Kid Rock white.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
A step below
Toadie's white.
Toadie's white. Where I do think that would really help. I think that if you discovered Toadie's, he might shift to a new victim. I don't see anybody losing their mind alive except literally just like this. You can't hear it because it's just. Like, it's like bored standing at the back of a concert.
Yeah.
Slowly nodding.
Yeah. Live white, Kid Rock white, and right below that, Stained white.
Stained white is. Something else.
That's really something else. And then above Toadie's white is Pearl Jam white.
Pearl Jam white is technically of that. And then
you can introduce Pearl Jam white to your family.
Now, the reason why Bunting loved Live so much was probably due to the content of their first single, released in 1994. That song was Selling the Drama, which you probably know is a song that goes like, I will, I walk, I feel, I talk, I know, ready, well, oh.
I didn't like Live.
Yeah.
I like Live.
I mean, they're a fine alt-rock band. They're the definition of middle-of-the-road 90s alt-rock.
We're going to get more letters about this, just the music conversation, more than we will have about anything that we talk about with the murders or gender.
I don't think it comes to anyone's surprise that I'm not the biggest fucking Live fan of the world.
I thought a more appropriate song for him to be playing while he was doing this was Alice in Chains. Man in the Box.
Yeah. Well, maybe he put his victims in a candle box.
But I like
Live. And then left them far behind.
I think Live is an extremely good series of karaoke songs for older men to do.
Yeah. Maybe he was just excited to make people unalive.
Yes.
Might have.
But the reason why John Bunting loved this song, Selling the Drama, was because of the lyrics of the chorus. And I guarantee that almost none of you, even if you've heard this song 1,000 times, know what those lyrics are.
I love this song and have sung this song. I believe I have sung this song at karaoke. And I did not know that these were the lyrics until we look back and I was like, oh, huh.
Yeah, they are.
Hey, now it won't be raped. Hey, hey, now it won't be scarred like that. Hey, hey.
And so on and so forth.
But I didn't know it was raped. I did not know it was raped.
Now we won't be raped.
Hey, hey.
Now we won't be scarred like that.
Hey, hey, ho, ho, ho.
But to make this synchronicity even more insane and to just wrap all this up and bring it full circle, Live is playing here in Los Angeles tomorrow.
Oh, that's why all the Rogaine is sold out. It's all gone.
But while lightning crashes possibly played in the background, Troy Ude was strangled with a rope that was leveraged with a metal rod to tighten it, just like how John Wayne Gacy used to do.
And how you find lightning with a metal rod.
Bunting, however, claimed that his hand was too hurt to do the twisting, so he told Jamie to do it instead. But when Jamie tried strangling his half-brother to death, the rope broke. Wagner tried to retie it, but it broke again. So Wagner ended up strangling Troy to death while Bunting kneeled and stared into Troy's eyes like the ridiculous edgelord that he is.
My love is like thunder.
Do you think Semi-Charmed Life came on? He's like, no!
No! Stop it!
Get it off!
Stop it! Get it off!
Get that piece of
shit off my radio! Times old!
Oh, God, that type of rap. That type of weird man rap.
But Troy's body was then wrapped in garbage bags and taken to the garage, where it was later placed in a barrel. But Bunting claimed that the barrel was just the tiniest bit too small to fit the whole body. So he cut off one of Ude's feet to make the tight squeeze and tossed the foot into parts unknown.
But as they did that, they were always supreme edgelords about it. So every single time they did it, I find it interesting because I do think that some serial killers strangely take an almost ritualistic approach to certain things where there's more of a sacred thing. You know, you see about how Dennis Rader talked about it being an art form. But these guys, every single time they did something, it would never be without a bunch of last podcast style jokes while they were doing it. Like they would cut off the feet and then the whole thing would be like, hey, I'm walking here. And they would do all this like fucked up shit with the feet. They would do all of this shit every time they did it. And it really just showed how, I mean, they're just gone full psychopath.
Well, that's why I say it's Beavis. They're very Beavis and Butthead.
They are.
Because they're giggling the entire time. They're making jokes.
Yes, they think it's all funny and it's all fun in games and then everybody likes it.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. If you're super scary and you're laughing like everybody likes what you're doing and then everybody else is laughing because they're scared of you, but you think that you're being right.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Which is a situation I found myself in a couple times where I just see people
who's
going,
ever
like,
been scared of you?
Yeah, I'm just saying the more that, all right, you know, like.
Oh, you've been the scared one.
Well, it's alienating. People.
Yeah. Anyone religious hates his clothes. I know that much.
Yeah, dude. I got a good stare at the other day, man, because we had the Mormon people on the street or whatever. Jehovah's Witnesses on the street.
Mm-hmm.
I had a good old fashioned Satan shirt on the suite.
That is nice.
Fuck yeah.
Just look at him, just like point at your shirt. You're like, yeah, go fuck yourself.
No, I didn't do that.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah.
You're growing.
Yeah, you are growing. My wife did give a very, I was proud at how firm her no thank you was the other day to the Jehovah's Witnesses who tried approaching our home.
No thank. Yeah, two Scientologists come at me with last time we were in Tampa, and you saw. It was like,
oh, you got real mad.
Well, because it was during a real mad time period, and I remember they came up to me as they were talking to me, and I was like, don't fucking talk to me.
Yeah. And you're like, do not follow us. Walk the other way. I was like, wow, that is upset.
Well,
yeah.
And see, with Scientologists, you're allowed to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, just don't get violent.
I don't.
No.
Well, as far as what John Bunting told Elizabeth, who, if you'll remember, was John's girlfriend, as well as both Jamie Vlasakis' and Troy Ude's mother, he said that Troy had gotten into a big fight with Bunting and ran off. And later, Bunting would use the recording he made in a fake phone call to Elizabeth to complete the story. As far as how Jamie, did that all that make sense?
Yes, he basically just, he lied to her and he said that
I mean, there's just so many people involved in this and so many stories and so much bullshit.
Where'd the foot go?
We don't know. That's actually been kind of a mystery in this whole thing. They actually kind of make a big deal out of it sometimes. It'd be like, we got no idea where that foot went. I'm like,
it's got to be Dingo.
They could have just thrown it in the pit. They still were burying some things in the backyard.
Yeah. Well, as far as how Jamie felt about the whole thing, he told Bunting that he enjoyed taking part in the murder of his half-brother. But according to what he later told authorities, he was lying because he was too scared to disagree with such a cold-blooded killer.
I think there's a solid demarcation 50-50 in there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's also the difference between fantasizing about murder
yes.
and actually being a part of it. And
yes.
I think that's what happened with this guy is that like the fantasy of it and thinking about this person who had hurt him so badly when he was a kid, thinking about killing him is that's somewhat cathartic. Everyone
yes.
does that. Everyone fantasizes about shit like that, like, you know, extreme violence, murder on somebody who's hurt you or wronged you or anything like that. Everyone has those sorts of thoughts. But the vast, 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 vast majority of people never carry them out because
no.
it's wrong.
Yes.
You can't do that. But Jamie Vlasakis found himself in a situation where somebody pulled him
Dude,
into that.
And it's sink or swim.
Yeah.
And, you know, you find yourself in a position where your hands are forced to do certain things. And then I find in a way, somebody like him, if you're in that environment, you have to find out a way to like it. You have to find a way to survive and thrive in this environment because thriving means not getting murdered.
Yeah.
And so you have to stay ahead of the extremely dangerous people that you are now involved in, which is the slippery slope, which is also why he did the thing later on of flipping.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, he's a real fucked up idiot who also yeah. just buried his best friend.
He's
yeah.
not,
you know, he's not
and
there.
That also knows for a fact he is for certain a potential victim.
Yeah.
He is right on that list. And actually, he is hovering between next. Each time if he does something wrong, he's bumping up on that list of who's going to get killed next.
Live from your grave.
Now, in 1998, Mark Hayden came back into John Bunting's life. If you'll remember, Mark Hayden was the taciturn dullard who'd helped John Bunting dig the tunnel, and he'd assisted in the disposal of the corpse of Clinton Trezise. But after years of doing God knows what, Hayden was now hanging out with Bunting and Wagner almost constantly, watching TV together or playing video games for hours at a time. In another somewhat confusing living situation, Mark Hayden was living with his wife, who was also named Elizabeth.
Just hang on here for a second.
As well as her two sons, her sister Gail, and Gail's teenage son, Fred Brooks.
This just shows that America is really not that far from Australia. This is just trailer park people.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. Trailer park family trees look like a spider's web all stuck to the inside of a leg of a big old man.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we said. We've been to Australia once, and Australia is very, out of every country that I've been to in the world, Australia is by far the closest to America.
Oh, sure.
Like, by
Same
far,
vibe.
It's America Junior. It's America without the guns.
Yeah.
And the entertainment.
Yeah. Well, they got some good stuff.
They Australia's do like incredible. I love the music. You know, I love Tame Impala, Amel and the Sniffers, King Gizzard. I love you.
Yeah. Oh, I love Amel and the Sniffers.
Yeah.
I want to see them.
Yeah, that'd be great if they're playing while we're there. But, I mean, what's, you know, how good is their TV, really?
Well, complicating matters more was the fact that Bunting was also having an affair with Gail and was telling his Elizabeth that he'd gotten a job as a truck driver and that's why he was away from home so much. Bunting's wife didn't question this claim because money was still coming in from all the murder victims' welfare payments. They're drawing, I think, it on like 5 or 6 accounts by this point. But unfortunately, since John Bunting was spending so much time at Mark Hayden's house having inadequate sex with Gail, he soon became convinced that Gail's 17-year-old son, Fred Brooks, was a pedophile, with no evidence whatsoever.
Yeah, they just did not like him.
This, of course, put Fred in mortal peril. Now, the dullard Mark Hayden was already all in on whatever scheme Bunting had for murdering whoever had been marked for death. So he agreed to store the barrels with the bodies of Vanessa Lane, Michelle Gardner, Gavin Porter, and Troy Ude in his garage. So remember that. The bodies and the barrels are now in Mark Hayden's garage. And presumably, Mark Hayden also didn't question Bunting after Fred Brooks vanished on September 17th, 1998. And here, my friends, is when we enter into Gold Star territory.
Very much so. Ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling.
Is that 7?
seven murders.
Yeah.
We're getting there.
We're getting there. Yeah, and because what we know is that he put the bodies, because they did too. I forgot how they sourced the acid that they would pour over the bodies.
I think they just bought it, but the thing is that they used the wrong kind of acid. They used hydrochloric acid when they were supposed to use sulfuric acid,
yes,
because sulfuric acid is the one that
eats everything.
That really eats everything. But with the hydrochloric acid, it just made it... you wanted soup and they got gumbo.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Do you remember the soup that had the big chunks? It's like that.
Oh, yeah. I think it was called Chunky Man.
Yeah, Chunky Man.
Just regular Chunky.
Yeah. But they apparently put it in there, and one of the truly worst problems with these barrels is that everywhere they'd sit, they'd leak.
Yeah.
So every house that they went to, the first time they started it, you know, obviously it takes time for these bodies to be slowly sous-viding inside of these barrels, and that what they would do is they'd leak out the bottom, and so they'd have to eventually leave because everywhere they went would smell like rotting flesh, and John Bunting had no sense of smell. So every time, he would always have to ask Jamie. Jamie was literally his canary.
Wow.
Where he'd go to Jamie and say, like, "Ah, you smell any dead bodies in here?" Because he couldn't do it. And Jamie would be like, "It's not as bad as it was yesterday."
Mm-hmm. Oh, it could be worse. These guys love to dig. Why not put it in the ground?
Because digging is very loud and a lot of people notice digging.
Yeah.
All right. You know, arguably killing a bunch of people you call pedophiles is loud as well.
Well, it depends on how loud the pedophile is.
So after tricking Fred into joining them at Bunting's home in Murray Bridge, Bunting, Wagner, and Jamie did a little song and dance in which they took another page from Gacy's handbook, showing Fred how much fun it was to put handcuffs on yourself. And so, when Fred joined in and put himself in handcuffs, Wagner wrapped his arm around Fred's neck while Bunting shushed for Fred to not make a sound. Bunting then told Fred that he was a pedophile and needed to, quote, go to the clinic. As they had most times before, Bunting and Wagner took Fred to the bathtub, stripped him naked, and bashed his genitals until they were grossly swollen. But with Fred, Wagner and Bunting took it to the next level by sticking lit cigarettes up Fred's nose and inside his ear. After that, Bunting grabbed his tape recorder and forced Fred to recite the same sorts of statements as he had with the rest, like, "Hey mom, it's me. I'm on my way to Perth, met a pretty nice chick, fuck off and leave me alone." But after finishing the messages and giving up all his bank details, Fred's toes were crushed by Robert Wagner, crushed with pliers, which seemed to be Wagner's favorite part. But the escalation on this murder didn't stop with the cigarettes. Next, Bunting pulled out an electrical transformer called a Variac, capable of delivering up to 260 volts of electricity. One of the Variac's alligator clips were attached to Fred's penis, while the other was clipped to his testicles. The first shock was set at 20 volts, but over a period of hours, they steadily increased the voltage while grilling him about his alleged and, from all indications, non-existent pedophilia.
You know what just hit me? Robert Wagner, the actor.
Yeah, just now, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, just now. I just saw number two from Austin Powers doing all of this. Like, literally.
Heart to heart.
As we were doing this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. As you were just describing it, I don't know why it took me to literally this moment. And then all of a sudden, I'm just seeing Robert Wagner do all this.
Yeah. You know what hit me during that is that in Australia, they're probably crocodile clips. Because they don't have alligators.
This is the kind of emails we get. Reddit comments we receive. I want you to understand that. EddieTunes.com.
Every second of this, by the way, was recorded by Bunting, and he listened to it afterwards as a sort of serial killer game tape. But after the electroshocks, Wagner delivered the coup de grace, one of the worst and weirdest tortures I've ever heard a serial killer use. Taking a metal party sparkler, Wagner shoved the handle inside Fred's penis. Then he lit it and let it burn down to the very tip. Then he did it again with a second sparkler. But when Bunting restarted the electrical shocks, Fred started screaming uncontrollably. So Bunting shoved a sock in Fred's mouth and wrapped his head in tape. Syringes filled with both bleach and water were then injected into Fred's testicles and legs, And finally, Frank died, most likely from asphyxiation. This was all because John Bunting thought that Fred might be a pedophile, which is why I've been saying for years, you can't just go around calling people pedophiles.
Unless you yourself have dressed up as a little boy with little, you got pigtails that you've got a wig on, you got a big lollipop, and you were then freshly molested by this pedophile while you were disguised as a child.
One thing I know is if there's two guys standing in a room and one's a pedophile and one's not, I'm usually going to say the one with the sparklers is the pedophile.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Yeah, yeah. Anybody that has brought bubbles out that doesn't have a toddler.
Now, after being wrapped in garbage bags, Fred's body was put into the trunk of a rundown car in the yard until it was later towed away by Mark Hayden. Hayden then dumped Mark's body on his garage floor until they could afford to buy another barrel. And when they did, Fred Brooks joined the other six as body in the barrel number 7.
And that really shows just how much collateral you need to be a serial killer and about how gatekeeping doesn't just stop in the entertainment business. And if you don't have the funds, like, oh yeah, sure, I would have loved to have started serial killing when I was in my early 20s, but I needed a full-time job.
Yeah, you gotta get that barrel money.
Yeah, dude. So how fucking dare you think, all you fucking Nepo killers that go out there with your fucking, oh, I killed other people and I'm taking their government money and that funds me, you're government funded. So think about that. You're not a socialist. Do better. Be better.
Now remember, John Bunting had been having an affair with Fred's mother, Gail, and Bunting told Gail when her son mysteriously disappeared that he'd last seen Fred getting into a car with some woman. Fred, he said, was also on a lot of speed and seemed really aggressive and was saying something about leaving town.
Yeah, holds out, yep.
Gail tried calling Fred's cell phone, but was greeted by a strange, abusive, outgoing message, which had, of course, been recorded while Fred was being tortured to death. Gail then made a missing persons report with the police, but 3 days later, the house where Gail was living got a call. On the other end was Fred's voice, but the person who answered was Gail's sister. Bunting had edited a tape together of Fred saying a bunch of mean shit, which it sounds really fucking dumb. It sounds like a prank a morning zoo DJ would play.
Yeah, it sounds very similar to Sal Governale. Like, they're just playing sound bites. They're doing the thing that you do in sound
Who
bites.
Who is your daddy and what does he do?
Yeah.
Never trust an editor.
We're sneaky. But apparently it was enough for Gail's sister to say, like, oh yeah, I guess Fred's okay. She just shrugged, called the police, and told them to cancel the missing persons report because Fred had called up and said that he was going to Perth, which is on the other side of the country, and he wanted everyone to leave him the fuck alone.
That's like one of those things that I just don't understand where it's like, I guess that's, they just weren't, it's a rough group.
It's a real rough group. It's a, like, real rough group of people, like, that Bunting and all these people are kind of in. It's a very, very rough group.
I've already talked about how I don't believe in Jackie's freedom if she's been brainwashed. Like, I believe that she needs to be saved, right, from one of these things. I think I'd flip out if she did one of these things, where I got a weird, strained phone call that sounded like she was under duress.
Yeah.
Like, you'd become like Liam Neeson.
Yeah. Yeah, you go find him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nope. These people actually called the police and said, never mind.
Yep, sorry, calling it off. Mm-hmm. All done.
Now, like most serial killers, the frequency of Bunting and Wagner's murders were increasing. Where before there had been years between killings, it was now down to a matter of weeks.
They were getting addicted.
In October of 1998, less than a month after Fred Brooks, Jamie recalled that he and Bunting were driving around when they spotted a man named Gary O'Dwyer. Now, just like every other victim, Gary was personally known to John Bunting. In fact, he was his next-door neighbor. Bunting, however, became obsessed with how, quote-unquote, gay Dwyer looked. Talked about it quite a bit, in fact. And he was soon talking about how much O'Dwyer looked like murder victim and actual pedophile, Troy Ude.
But Gary O'Dwyer, he was the one. This poor guy.
This guy was a poor soul. Poor soul.
He's a horrible realtor.
Yeah. I hate this bungalow now. No, he was severely fucked up.
Yeah, in a lot of different ways. But And at the end, like, he's just some dude.
Yeah.
I mean, he'd gotten addicted to drugs and alcohol after being the victim of a vicious hit and run. He'd suffered from epileptic seizures since he was a kid.
He had a bad limp. He couldn't do math anymore. Like, he literally had fucked up his brain, so he couldn't do any sort of executive function.
Yeah.
He was just dumb.
And this all seemed gay to...
Yeah, I don't know how any of this. I agree with you. I don't know how any of this translates to gay.
Can you imagine getting hit by a car like traumatically, but then all of a sudden it's just like you making delicious radicchio like salads, like you like going out to like, you know, talking about really wonderful vacation spots in Palm Springs, how much you love going to fucking the Cape, and like, you know, like all that kind of shit.
But Gary also had an uncontrollable temper, making him, again, an inconvenient person to have as a next-door neighbor.
Yeah, that's the problem. It's not, the only thing he did wrong was be a bad neighbor, but only a bad neighbor like a dog's bad. He just was not, he was all fucked up.
Probably has brain damage.
Yes, he did.
Absolutely had brain damage. Well, yes. I mean, that's what I said in the last episode, is that Salisbury North seemed like at this time to be a place where they just kind of shoved people. Like, just put them in Salisbury North, give them some welfare payments, and we can just forget about these, we can forget these people exist.
You know what's happening here? This is the cast of Meet the Feebles.
Yeah.
This is Meet the Feebles live.
Wow. Wow. That's incredible. Well, according to Bunting, O'Dwyer was a, quote, pathetic, epileptic piece of waste. And Bunting fantasized endlessly about murdering Gary. He then set on the task of getting to know Jamie to see if they could kill him without drawing too much attention, and to see if his disability checks were big enough to take the risk.
I got it. Let's send our most charismatic member. Let's send a little heroin boy out to be our spy.
Well, sadly, Gary O'Dwyer had no idea he was being cased. He just thought that Jamie was a new friend.
Oh, God. Also, just the idea of Gary O'Dwyer didn't think he was going to be cased. Cased for what?
Yeah, and Jamie was merely the bait. And after Bunting decided to go ahead with the murder, Jamie was the one tasked with taking Gary out to the pub and inviting him back to Gary's place for a nightcap.
Well, this is how much of a pussy John Bunting truly is, where he needed this person with a literal physical and mental disability to get drunk before he could go ahead and physically dominate a person that also was smaller than him.
Yeah. Bunting and Wagner soon joined them at Gary's house, but after just a few minutes of drinking and talking, Wagner stood up and grabbed Gary by the throat, which caused Gary to go into a seizure. Once the episode subsided, Bunting and Wagner put on the handcuffs, pulled Gary's mattress into the kitchen, and laid Gary on top to ask him about his alleged pedophilia, I suppose, to see if they could shoehorn this murder into their overall mission.
Kind of sounds like Abu Ghraib.
Yeah.
Gary got the same incredibly cruel treatment as Fred, with the shocks to the genitals, the sparklers, the cigarettes, the toe crushing, everything. And this, I think, is actually the greatest irony of the whole Snowtown murder saga. See, the men who weren't pedophiles got the worst torture. This was because they had nothing to confess to, and Bunting and Wagner kept going harder and harder to try and elicit a confession to something that didn't happen, all so they could justify what they were doing.
But they didn't need the justification, nor did they even care to get it. They just liked the process of torturing, and it does sort of feel like it was an end game in and of itself.
But they only did it to the guy, like the guys who were actual pedophiles, like Troy, like, you know, like Yude. He didn't get the horrible treatment that the other guys got.
Because they were on the first half.
I suppose so.
This is the natural, now we're seeing the natural escalation of serial killers to the point where John Bunting and Robert Wagner are both so bored with what they're doing, and that they're looking for ways to make it more exciting for them.
But they don't do it with the next victim.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, they're all over the place.
I think it really is. They're trying to get some sort of confession out of them. And so they're just going work, because the other guy, because you just like, I'm a pedophile.
Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah.
And then like, I molested my brother. Yeah. I think they're just trying to justify it.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, they've got to be like just so bored. This all comes from that. I mean, they're sitting there with just one live CD and like trying to fucking like be entertained. You know, they got one PlayStation game.
That's all they had. They didn't
played
even
fucking Q-Bert over and over again.
Please, Twisted Metal 2.
There's like no, like, what's its butts? No tub thumping? What else is Australian?
Chumbawamba? No, that's England.
That's England. What's in the come on, Arlene. And, come on, Arlene.
Dexy's Midnight Runners?
Where's the Dexy's Midnight Runners?
Yeah. I suppose
so. That's your Australian hometown boys, Toto.
Yeah. Oh, they're Australian, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Grong Grong. I like them a lot. But at any rate, around 9 o'clock, Jamie said he felt ill and he left the house. But after Gary had been tortured to death, Jamie was brought back to help loot Gary's possessions. Within a few days, Gary's body was in a barrel in Mark Hayden's garage. But as it turned out, no recorded tape messages were necessary. The only connection Gary O'Dwyer had to anyone was to his former foster mother. He was 29 by this point, and from what she said, it just didn't occur to her to report Gary as a missing person.
Well, they weren't in communication anymore. By that point, Gary sort of was living on his own, and his problems had made him not super easy to take care of.
Yeah. I got lots of family I haven't talked to in months. You know, like,
of course. But that's not to say that nobody investigated any of these missing people. After Vanessa Lane disappeared, it was discovered that money was still being withdrawn from her account 9 months later in Adelaide, even though she'd supposedly moved to Queensland. Video surveillance showed that the person withdrawing the money was Robert Wagner, so a detective had a team shadow Wagner 6 times over 6 months in 1998. But since there was no direct evidence of a major crime, the surveillance was limited and requests for additional manpower were denied.
Yeah, I don't really understand what happened with the beginning of this. I do understand. I think that's good, what we were saying before. They don't care that Vanessa Lane was dead.
And if this was America, the cops would have just beat the shit out of them and found out some stuff then.
Honestly, I don't know if they put it past the Australian police every once in a while to knock a guy about.
But had police looked a bit more into Robert Wagner's life, they would have certainly found John Bunting, and they just may have been able to prevent the disappearance and death of Mark Hayden's wife, Elizabeth. Now, John Bunting had always hated Elizabeth Hayden, and while that might have been enough for him to kill her at this point, it's probably more likely that Elizabeth was killed because she knew too much.
She did seem like a fine woman. Maybe.
I have no idea.
She was
married to Mark Hayden.
Yeah, yeah.
She's not a good thing.
She's not a full accomplice, but she had an almost Miss Piggy-like obsession with John Bunting.
Mm.
She was sexually obsessed. She saw that man.
This is the second time you've used Miss Piggy as a way to describe a sexual attraction between a woman and a man.
Well, it's because of the way it was. Elizabeth Hayden was a lot like, oh, Johnny. Like, it was very much, she was interested.
I don't think Miss Piggy could take John Bunting, personally.
I would love
she
to
knows
see
karate.
It. I would pay that. Save that for March Madness. Next year.
Next year, Miss Piggy is going to be a top seed.
It's John Bunting.
Well, the reason why Elizabeth knew too much was not only because there were 6 bodies in barrels rapidly decomposing in her garage, but because Mark Hayden had also told his wife about the murders, presumably after she asked, what the fuck was stinking so much out in the garage?
Well, for so long, they kept saying it was the kangaroo.
Yeah.
So they were saying that they were culling kangaroos and had kangaroo meat around, and so it was just rotting in the sun.
Yeah.
Which they were doing, right?
I think that there was some in there.
Cool.
And so, sometime in late November 1998, Bunting told Mark Hayden to clear out of the house and take Gail with him. Hayden did what he was told and went for a drive with Gail. And while he was gone, his wife was tortured and killed in her own bathroom. Her body was then drug out to the garage and placed in a barrel, marking body number 8. Now, with this murder, Bunting and Wagner couldn't really do the whole voice recording ruse because there were too many people who'd just seen her. So Bunting, Hayden, and Wagner came up with a story and told police that Elizabeth had left home drunk one night and ran away with a new boyfriend.
These guys truly have more sex than any group of supermodels you have ever met. There is something about this style of white trash that just
it's not just it, this style. It's I trust
got,
me.
Everyone's got seven kids.
They're
I know.
All
yeah, growing
so horny.
Growing up in a town where there's like a lot of these types of people around, they're all fucking all the time.
Dude,
and there's it's not even. There's inbreeding. There's everyone. Everyone is fucking. It's fucking horrible.
Is it what? What is it about it? Because it's like
it's boredom, and I'm it's horny. Also like it's just straight instinct.
Yeah, I guess you think that's what it is. It's just no impulse control. So
no,
just
no
kind of
impulse
each
control.
Other.
At, none of these people have impulse control.
They all
at
start
all.
Fuck. I remember like all the kids that were in like the bad neighborhood where I grew up. They were fucking at like 12.
Yeah,
yeah.
It was
yeah.
like terrifying.
Yeah. But there's no way that like John Bunting was like good at sex.
No. No, I don't think any of them were particularly good at sex.
Yeah, I don't think he really cared about the female orgasm.
Yeah.
But maybe he had one of those weird fat dicks, the ones that are like really big in the middle.
Oh, potato dicks.
Potato dicks.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, lots of eyes.
Yeah. Odd tools.
Well, when their first story was proved to be full of holes, they changed it to something far more complicated, involving a visit to Mark's father, and a fight, and a girlfriend, and all sorts of extra people. Way too much to keep straight. And Mark Hayden, at this point, like, he when he saw his wife's dead body, reportedly, he laughed.
Well, he also apparently didn't like it, and they would all make fun of her. They yeah. all got together and would make fun of her, the way she dressed, the way she talked. And it's not.
Well, because this story wasn't adding up, Elizabeth's brother reported her missing, and the police started asking more questions. Questions soon turned into statements, and statements turned into searches. Specifically, police got a search warrant for Mark Hayden's home, where the bodies and the barrels were being kept. Police arrived and found Elizabeth's purse, ID, bank cards, and wedding ring. Luminol was also sprayed around the house to check for traces of blood, and traces were found in the laundry room. Investigators then opened the door to the garage, and even though they smelled the stench of death and found maggot casings scattered about the floor, the bodies in the barrels weren't there. That's because Bunting and Wagner had already moved them to Snowtown, and that's where we'll pick back up for the conclusion to our series.
We have a lot left to cover. This is a huge story.
We were going
to
do this in two, but there's just so much.
It was going to be a 2.5-hour episode. So this was, I'm excited for this. This is a story that I find interesting, sadly.
No, it's fascinating. Yeah. It's absolutely fascinating.
The book's good. You know, I'm reading it last night. Like, Natalie's like, what you eating? I was just like, oh, you want me to describe?
Yeah.
And then, she didn't enjoy it. But this is what we're going to come back. We're going for a little bit of a break. But we're not.
Yeah.
The show is not, but us as humans are. Mm-hmm. And we're going to come back with episode 3 of this after next week. But you will like it.
Next week, well, we might as well go ahead and tell people what next week is going to be. Next week is the LPN spring break.
Woo!
This is when the whole network goes and takes a little bit of a vacation. And so for that week, we've pre-recorded an interview with John Wayne Gacy's last lawyer.
This is honestly, it's fascinating.
Really cool. It's fascinating. It's with the woman who tried to save John Wayne Gacy from the death penalty. Great interview. She's got a new book out. It's a lot of fun. We hope you guys enjoy it. But after that, we're going to come back with the Snowtown Murders Part 3 and the next two series after that. I'm so excited for what we have going this spring. So much cool shit.
Yeah, honestly, and it's all cooking. It's really good.
It's cooking hearts. Thank y'all so much for listening. Do not forget to go to patreon.com/lastpodcast on the left to watch full video of these episodes we're recording.
You see our jowl shake.
Yeah. You can go to TikTok and Instagram and follow us at LP on the left. And be sure to check out LPN TV on Twitch. That's twitch.tv/LPN TV. We're also available on YouTube after the shows have aired. And of course, go to lastpodcastontheleft.com to see all of our tour dates for this year. We got a ton in North America.
We're coming around.
And we're coming to Australia. We're fucking coming to Adelaide.
Yeah, we are.
So we can't wait for that shit.
Can't wait to meet some of these recently released.
we'll meet them.
Hi,
Mark. Hi. Hey, Mark, hey. See if we can get him for the show.
Yeah, that'd be great. And we're also doing England this year in October. We're going to be doing 2 dates in London in October. So make sure to go check out those dates to see if you can make it. And we're also, I'm so fucking excited. We're doing Reykjavik this year. Finally, after years of talking about it, we're going to be doing the Harpa.
We're going to be doing the big fucking concert hall. I mean, we're not doing the big room.
The big, big
We're not
one.
Doing the big room.
Yeah.
No, of course not. But all y'all out there in Reykjavik, I know you like to wait till the last minute. Go on out and buy your tickets now.
Yeah.
Can't wait to come and eat a bunch of lamb and I'll show you guys.
Fish.
I can't wait.
No, I'll show you guys fucking Icelandic hot dogs.
All right.
Fucking incredible.
Are you just going to show us your penis?
Yeah, yeah. You can show us your penis.
Yeah. It can be a Los Angeles hot dog.
We don't have to do it in Reykjavik in October. But yeah, that's October 18th and 20th in London and October 22nd in Reykjavik. So can't wait to see y'all out on the road this year.
Yeah. Yes, also, side stories. Live May 9th
at the Netflix is a Joke special at the Masonic Lodge in Los Angeles. We're gonna have some special guests. It's gonna be really fun. And go check on this new project we've been working on. It's called lemonparty.org. And you're gonna wanna just type that into your URL. It's been a minute. I was looking at it this morning.
Yeah, I was on page 7 this week. Go nice. Listen to that. It was a lot of fun. And this week you can catch me at Outback Steakhouses all across Los Angeles doing research, getting the barrel onion soup.
Yeah, you're gonna love it.
And don't forget to listen to Brighter Side as well.
That's right. We're rocking and rolling. Two shows a week now. Brighter Side Stories on Wednesday and Brighter Side Proper on Friday.
It's going to be great.
It's going to be great, y'all.
See you, fuckers. Hail Satan.
Huggie.
Bang.
Nobody. I got nobody.
You got nobody this time?
I got no one.
No.
Hail the cop, maybe? Maybe. He's still fucked up. He still missed it.
You know what I'm going to go ahead and say? I want to give him the dupe. I like the Toadies.
Hail the Toadies!
Yeah.
Hail the Toadies!
Yeah, Hail the Toadies! Yeah, the Toadies, they're a good Texas band. Hell they used to play Lubbock all the time. Yeah, Hail the Toadies, why not?
Also, R.E.M. is better.
R.E.M. is by far the best out of all those bands.
Do you think so?
Yeah, I'm a massive R.E.M. fan. Yeah. R.E.M., Hail R.E.M.
I still like Alice in Chains the most.
I don't like them.
I don't know if everyone does hurt.
This show is made possible by listeners like you. Thanks to our ad sponsors, you can support our shows by supporting them. For more shows like the one you just listened to, go to lastpodcastnetwork.com.